Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Ryan Bankin for Melissa Ross. She's on vacation this week. We're always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, all the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, it's summertime, and that means rambunctious young ones are home without school to channel their energy. We'll talk with some UF health injury prevention experts about what parents can do to ensure their kids stay safe and free from injury over the next couple of months. Plus, we'll talk with one artist who says there's a schism within the local arts community. So she's launching a new campaign to develop talent that may have been passed up by Jacksonville's mainstream. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly media roundtable. Here today is Mark Woods of the Florida Times Union.
Good morning.
Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
And WJCT news analyst John Burr.
Hey, Ryan.
And lots to discuss, from new election year polls to a Supreme Court ruling on a Texas abortion law and a federal judge's tossing of similar Florida legislation. But we begin with Reginald Gaffney, a story of machine politics, money, and Kareem Brown. That's the title of a recently published profile of the Jacksonville City Councilman in the Florida Times Union. The piece details Gaffney's struggling nonprofit, Community Rehabilitation Center, Inc., and its federal subpoena in the criminal investigation into Congresswoman Kareem Brown. The story has produced quite a backlash from Gaffney, who questioned whether the TU is racist. Mark, since you're here representing the TU, I'd like to start with you. Your thoughts?
Well, I think the piece laid out and detailed some pretty long-running issues and questions, and which obviously are even more relevant today with the investigation involving Kareem Brown. And I believe he called it a witch hunt, and I thought, you know, Kareem Brown also said the same thing. She said it's a witch hunt, and I'm the witch they're trying to get. but Angela Corey has said the paper's out to get her and has in the past tried to threaten to sue one of our columnists. Lenny Curry had said during his campaign that we were the liberal media wrapping its arms around Alvin Brown, even though the paper endorsed Lenny Curry. So the common denominator here, my point is there's a long list of people who think we're out to get them, and the common denominator isn't race or gender, or Democrat, or Republican, it's that they're public officials. And that's what the paper tries to do, is get answers to some pretty valid questions, I think. And that's what this story laid out, I thought, very well.
And again, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 549-2937. Anyone else with any more thoughts on this?
You know, I have heard this perception of the Times Union as being a racist paper, and I strongly disagree with that. I don't think the paper's racist. I don't think its writers are racist at all. I think they did excellent work on this story. That being said, I think that sometimes what happens and what the public is unaware of is that there are operatives who feed us information. And when it comes to the Republican side, they just happen to be far more organized and far more helpful. And I mean, journalists are, we're in the business of printing the news. And if someone brings us a great story, we're going to print the news regardless of what party, what race they belong to.
Well, the door was opened here with the subpoena, where
there's
obviously the story did a good job of stitching together a lot of different things, some of which have been out there for a while. But
as far back as 2010, I think some
The thing that made this a story is he's gotten subpoenaed, and there's always that, you know, somewhat maybe bristling thing that journalists have when they're accused of unfairly targeting people, when you look and go, but he got subpoenaed, it's kind of like that.
It would almost be a dereliction of duty if the paper didn't start looking into an organization, especially a publicly funded one run by a city councilman, that got subpoenaed by the feds. I mean, come on. That's like a red flag.
I would say historically there are issues not only with the Times Union, but with newspapers across the country. If you look at our civil rights coverage, if you look at Axe Handle Saturday, the way the paper covered that. So I can understand a lingering perception in the African American community. I certainly get that going back decades to the way the paper did or didn't, and often the case, didn't cover things.
Right.
But to also say, you know, for Corinne Brown to claim this is a witch hunt and some of the questions that are out there that remain unanswered, I just don't think it's valid.
Yeah, and it's a lot easier for a politician to say, well, you know, it's irrelevant what I've done. What's relevant is that I'm being targeted unfairly. You know, that's what they would fall back on when they don't have a good answer to the question that's being asked of them.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a local activist, Denise Hunt. I think I've seen her on multiple posts on Facebook calling the TU racist and saying the TU has a history of being conservative or leaning conservative. Whether or not that's true, I mean, I don't know how that fits into this particular story.
Conservative equals racist? Is that what's... You know, I mean, it's a little too simplistic.
She also self-identifies as a Republican, from my understanding, too, doesn't she?
I'm not sure. But, you know, it's kind of like the Donald Trump bashing the media. Like Claire says, when you get in a tight spot and you're in politics, it's always great to, you know, try to kill the messenger. But in this case... the paper is just following up on, you know, I think any paper with an investigative arm, which the Times Union has had for a long time, under the circumstances would have jumped on this.
Right. And does anybody want to kind of, for our listeners, kind of explain the genesis of this story? I mean, I feel like we have to mention what Corinne Brown is under investigation for. She had a relationship with a charity that was shown to be a fraud, essentially, or documents show was fraudulent. And Reggie Gaffney has a relationship with Corinne Brown, and this is the connection that the paper made in this column. Right? Is that?
Yeah, in the broad outlines, that's correct. Obviously, Corinne Brown is somebody who has had rumors swirl around her for years. There is an argument that she has particular attention paid to her because she's a powerful politician, and people will say things about her. I know if AG was here, he oftentimes will explain that there might be a tinge of racism to that. But I think the particular genesis now is this particular charity situation that clearly has at least indication that there might be some wrongdoing there.
You're being kind, I think.
I mean, if you want to follow
quite
this.
A bit of hundreds of thousands of dollars funneled to this charity up in Virginia.
Right.
This is the genesis of
local
all this.
Money.
Local money, with Congresswoman Brown being at the forefront of that money being funneled there, being raised for this charity that is...
Yeah, it was One Door for Education. I believe it was something like $800,000 that was raised, and it was supposed to give scholarships to underprivileged children, and $1,000 was given.
If you want to really follow this, you know, this thought of racism to its logical beginning, you'd have to say that the federal prosecutors are racist, because all these journalism has come out of the original interests from federal prosecutors. So, it's if you want to go there and say the federal government and the U.S. Attorney's Office is racist, you know, be my guest. But you know, that's a really hard thing to prove, especially if you know these folks are found, you know, to have done something wrong.
Right. I want to go to your calls now. Chris in Gainesville. Chris, what is your thought? What are your thoughts?
I'm sitting here listening. I'm down visiting down from the liberal bastion of Massachusetts, and I hear this conversation. It's interesting for me to hear it. And I want to ask you guys, I'm taking too far off topic, but you talk about this corruption and the investigation and the obligation of journalists to follow through on this, whether they want to or not. And I want to see if any of you parallel this to what's going on with Hillary Clinton and the Department of Justice and the goings on there, and it seems to me to be obstruction, and there's not any investigation going on in the mainstream media. I want to know if you guys feel the same way, if there's any frustration, or if you see that as a different set of circumstances.
All right, thank you for your call. So how about that? I mean, I think there has been plenty of stories out there about the email scandal, and every time a new batch is released, there's a lot of journalists that are sifting through this, but maybe that's not necessarily the perception that everyone sees.
Yeah, maybe it's old paper. I mean, how many years have we been talking about those emails? Yeah, I mean, it's over and done. It's just being dragged along because of the campaign. I don't think that it's that important to voters, and I don't think it should be. It's in the past. We need to move on.
I always find it interesting when people talk about things the media aren't covering, and as an example, they pull out the things that they learned from the media. Mm-hmm. And this makes sense on anything that you care deeply about that you don't think other people do. Kind of an argument, well, if we just wrote one more story about Benghazi, like that would explain to people how big of a problem it is. Well, it's been written about a lot. The people who care, everybody else doesn't. There's a level of the media can't, you know.
Yeah, I got something. I remember once somebody sent me something about Benghazi and said, why won't the main... Everybody should read this. Why won't the mainstream media cover this? And the why won't everybody should read this was a lengthy Washington Post story detailing the chronology of it. It doesn't get much more mainstream than Washington Post.
The alt-weekly Washington Post. I mean,
Washington Post. What are you saying about weeklies, Tim?
Very similar.
Hey, watch it now.
We've got a couple more calls. Let's go now to Bill in Arlington. Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning. A very intelligent panel you have there. He is being quite kind after I personally have been the brunt of A.G. Gankarski. I'm sure if A.G. was there today, he'd have a lot to say. But I don't think that the Times Union tends to fall into a racist print whenever they do stories like this. I think sometimes in the past, the TU has been a little more biased towards some stories than others. But, you know, that's the nature of being a political figure or having a different point of view than the majority. Sometimes the majority is offered something that proves that they're not quite going down the right path, and those that offer that alternative view are sometimes singled out and thought to be wrong. With the case of this city councilman, though, it probably would be nice if the Times Union article had forced him to come out and be a little more open as to his relationship with Corinne Brown and others. But I think the TU does a fine job of walking that line between conservative and liberal and kind of expressing both points of view.
Thank you. So, Mark, how about that?
I mean, it's funny. I do hear from conservative friends that, you know, that liberal rag, and then I heard from liberal friends, oh, paper endorsed another Republican, you know. So it's you know, when both sides kind of feel that way,
You're doing your job if they're all mad at you.
Yeah, there's certainly politicians mad on both sides. So, I just don't buy that there's this real strong bias one direction or the other.
All right. We have a couple more calls, and I want to get to them. But speaking of Corinne Brown, there's also a new poll that is not really spelling good tidings for her. It shows that she is basically in a statistical dead heat with Senator Al Lawson, or former state Senator Al Lawson. She's got about 30% of likely Democratic voters behind her. Lawson has about 27%, but there's a 5% margin of error. How much do you think the federal investigation and all these this negative news coverage has to do with this? Or is it the change in districts?
It's a change in districts that's finally kind of wide open. And I found out of the most interesting stat was 40% didn't know or wouldn't answer. So there's this just huge amount of undecided voters. So that's very intriguing, you know, and I have no idea which way they'll, you know, by the end, which direction they'll go.
I was grabbed by that stat as well. And I mean, at this point in the election, to have almost half of it, you know, at least officially undecided is an interesting finding. You know, typically the undecideds break for the incumbent, but there's not really an incumbent here in the same sense because of the district change. So you got to assume that plays a large part in you know, how people are deciding.
It would be interesting to know how what percentage of those undecideds live in Jacksonville or around here. She has a built-in advantage in this race, obviously, because most of the people in the district live in and around Jacksonville. And she's, you know, you can say what you want to about Corinne Brown, but she's got a very deep and very loyal following here. And, you know, it's I think if the federal prosecutors actually move on something and name her in some sort of legal action, that's gonna really skew it. That's gonna be very tough for her to overcome. But if, you know, if we come up to November and we're still looking, you know, at what we have today, she could very well win.
Claire, you've reported on like sort of the, or written about the sort of anemic nature of like the local Democratic Party and not putting up candidates in certain races, state attorney and public defender. But do you think that if this investigation kind of moves forward, naming her as John says, mm-hmm. that gives Lawson that much more credibility?
I don't think it gives him as much of an advantage as it could, because Corrine just has such a strong base. People love her, and they have for a long time. They're very committed. I think one of the things that hurts her that she may not even be aware of is the HUD issues, actually. She's been in Congress for how many years, and we're still having these HUD issues. That's a federal problem. Al Lawson is going to people in the district, and he's saying, are your lives better? And honestly, I don't think the answer is yes. That is what's going to hurt her, because for years and years, she's been talking about all the pork that she brings back. Like, this is improving things for people. But is it really improved things for people in Northwest Jacksonville? I mean, obviously, it's a very complex problem. But when you're putting yourself out there as the person who is the knight in shining armor for the district and no one's being saved from the dragon, you're going to have problems.
Another stat I found interesting was 52% in Duval County. So it's not this everybody on board in the Democratic in her district. She has her prominent enemies in among that community. So I don't know. I don't know how it'll play out.
To go back to the racism discussion for a second, I thought I had then that actually fits in with this. Sometimes we talk about the African-American political structure in Jacksonville like it is a monolithic thing, and it's not. There are coalitions, there are different sides, there are people who want their own power, there are people who have different ideas on how to help the community. So it came up in the discussion of racism from targeting one leader does not mean you're targeting the community, but it also comes up here where, just because Corrine delivers doesn't mean that, she's the only person seen as able to do that.
All right. And again, if you want to join the conversation, the number is 549-2937. Chuck in Jacksonville. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. You were talking about Corrine Brown and how the journalists were looking at it, and then the gentleman called in and he made the analogy between Hillary Clinton, and the comment was made, well, why are we still commenting about Benghazi, and why are we still talking about her emails? I have in my hand a book I read by Doris Kearns Goodwin, which is 750 pages long. It's about the Abraham Lincoln administration. And a third of that book is quotes from newspapers and journalists who got it right and who got it wrong. The good news is the truth will come out. And you guys are being recorded today, and your grandchildren are going to listen to what you say. Custer's Last Stand, think of how many books were written on that and how many thesis papers were written on that. And so what you say, the truth will come out about Benghazi. And what you say about it will be recorded. We will find out what happened sooner or later. Thanks for letting me share.
Sure. Thanks, Chuck. I think it's also worthy to mention that I don't even remember what the exact number was, but the very expensive Benghazi report was released recently, and even from her most vehement critics, there really wasn't a finding of wrongdoing, from my understanding. So I don't know. Does this close the chapter on that?
No, it does not.
It never
will. That is one thing I can utterly confidently say is no. It does not close the chapter. We'll still be talking about
maybe
it.
Maybe after the election, will it close the chapter on that?
Maybe.
No. I mean, Bill Clinton's probably still answering questions about blue dresses and cigars. Yeah. It's just never going away.
But now you're hearing criticism of the media that they've misreported what the Benghazi report says, that you're hearing that the Benghazi report actually says, a lot of pretty damaging things about the way Hillary Clinton acted. And, we're now into interpretations of what a report says. And, people are playing both sides of that. No. The answer is no. We're going to be hearing about this for a long time.
All right. I want to get to some more calls. Dave on the South Side. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, this is Dave Bruderly from the South Side, and I just want to take a little exception to your comment about the anemic state of the Democrats in this community. I filed a run for the House seat, District 4, the Crenshaw seat, on Friday, because the Republicans engineered another Angela Cori fiasco whereby we would have had a closed primary to elect that member of Congress had I not filed. So Democrats are willing to fight for democracy. We're willing to fight for transparency and freedom and democratic process. And we're not going to just sit still and allow one party in this plantation community to dominate the political debate. So I challenge y'all to help give me the opportunity to earn media coverage to debate the issues of the time that are relevant to the people of this community and to have a real political debate about who's going to represent us in District 4 of the U.S. Congress. Oh. And the same would apply for the other seats in this community that are also being contested. Just don't give all the press time to the Republicans because they're going to have a raucous primary arguing over their issues. Give equal time to all of us.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Is there a Republican that's filed for Corrine Brown's seat? I don't believe so. But, I mean, back to what the caller is saying. There are some very passionate people in the Democratic Party. There are some people that are committed that will spend every day of their lives fighting for the issues that are important to them. The problem is that it's fractured and there's just no fall-in-line party machine like there is on the Republican side. I mean, that's a bit of a categorization, but it's true. You know, you look at how cohesive they are locally. Nationally, not so much, but locally, the Republican Party is extremely cohesive. The Democratic Party is essentially two parties, social liberals and social conservatives. So, I mean, it's very hard to get people to fall in line when you have such division in, on the issues.
So I want to move on a little bit because we have a lot more to cover. In another poll from Bay News 9, it shows that Senator Marco Rubio, who recently announced that he will in fact run for re-election, is neck and neck with Democrat Patrick Murphy, although he's kind of destroying his only competition left in the GOP primary by, 71% to 7% for Carlos Baruff. Should the Marco Rubio campaign be worried about this?
Well, yes, they should be. I mean, obviously, you don't want to be in a highly contested race. But, you know, I think people are going to get over the fact that Rubio said he would never run for the Senate again and has flip-flop on that. And is. I think people get over that. And, you know, he's going to be a hard one to beat. I mean, he's extremely popular in this state, not just with Republicans. A lot of people like him.
He wouldn't have gotten back into the race if he wasn't pretty confident he could win. Now, obviously, no politician gets into a race they think they'll lose, but this one in particular, the kind of flip-flopping sort of decision-making in some ways points to his own internal polling showing that he has a very good shot here.
Yeah, he probably does. I think he probably will answer questions about the 15% of votes that he missed while in the Senate. But Patrick Murphy recently has been criticized for misstating his own resume. I know the Miami, I want to say it was the Miami Herald, CBS Miami, that put this report together where he said that he had 2 degrees and he has one. He said that he was a small business owner. He really wasn't. It was just his father's business. Here's a 33-year-old congressman who was a Republican as recently as 2012 and is rather centrist on the issues, which is probably good for him in a lot of the state. But he's just not a slam dunk candidate for the Democrats.
Yeah, he's not without his own problems. And this is just one poll. So, I mean, how much can one poll really tell us? I mean, is that
the bigger question, Marco Rubio, as far as I'm concerned, is, don't you think in 2 years he's going to be gearing up his presidential campaign?
He said he wasn't going to.
Oh, come on. Well, that seals it, I guess. I'll be quiet.
No. And it is a big gamble because if he doesn't win, to your point, it becomes very difficult. If you've lost, mm-hmm. I think it's one thing to not succeed in a presidential primary, but if he loses here, you know, where does his political path lead?
Even if he wins, though, I mean, you look historically, people who've lost presidential primaries and then go back to the Senate generally do not come back and win. I mean, it's like there's no other path for him to go on. It's not like he can, you know, go and just sit out for 2 years and come back and have that work. But it's not like there's a long track record of people losing, going back to Congress, and then winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And moving on from there, late Thursday, a federal judge, Robert Hinkle Jr., tossed a Florida law that was passed earlier this year stripping Planned Parenthood and affiliated groups that conduct abortions of state funding. That ruling comes just a few days after the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated a Texas law that required abortion doctors to have admitting privileges before conducting the procedure. Now the Florida ruling will probably be appealed and could theoretically wind its way up to SCOTUS, but what do these rulings mean for the pro-life or anti-abortion movement here in Florida?
I mean, it's like a whack-a-mole. You hit one and it's just pop up somewhere else.
I was going to say more fundraising letters from both sides. I mean,
another debate that will just never end.
Yeah. We're just going to keep spending millions of dollars litigating these issues. And meanwhile, people like Van Zandt are going to put them forth to the legislature every single year. And maybe it'll pass and maybe it won't. And then again, we're going to have to pay as taxpayers to go and challenge these and defend these unconstitutional laws. When, I mean, Florida, to get a little bit into the legal side of it, the United States Constitution has an implied right to privacy under the Fourth Amendment. The Florida Constitution has an implicit right to privacy. Now, that's important because abortion is guaranteed under the right to privacy, and Florida's right to privacy is much stronger than the federal right to privacy. So, honestly, it was likely that this law would have failed. These laws about ambulatory surgical procedure, meeting ambulatory surgical facility standards and having admitting privileges at hospitals to perform abortions, they probably would have failed under Florida law. We wouldn't even have needed to pursue a federal action.
In terms of what's going to happen on the ground outside of the courthouse, it's my understanding that the Florida law, even if it had been implemented in its full, would not have closed down any clinics here in Florida.
Planned Parenthood told me it was half their clinics would have closed.
And I think they said the number that the money that they would lose would be like around $500,000. And we're talking about a state that has a budget in billions. So I'm actually interested to see how much money each side is paying right now to fight the law and defend the law, and how much money they're actually, how that compares to the $500,000 that they're fighting over. Do you think I guess I already asked this, but there's no finality to this debate. I guess it's going to continue, but, I mean, SCOTUS did rule on the admitting privileges law, and that's going to affect probably more states than it does actually Florida.
Well, there is a finality, and it's the Supreme Court ruling. And, if Pam Bondi decides to, run this up to, the appeals court, that's a brick wall that she ain't going to get over. I mean, I'm sorry, but the Supreme Court was very clear on the provisions that it found to be unconstitutional.
Yeah, and weirdly enough, this debate also relates to a recent Senate vote to block a bill that would have given states $1 billion to fight the Zika virus. It was actually the same week. GOP senators attached some amendments to that spending bill, further cutting funding for Planned Parenthood, and Democrats called it a poison pill, said they wouldn't vote for it. And of course, now both sides are accusing the other of playing politics with a health crisis.
I find interesting having some very pro-life friends who are kind of outraged by this entire thing, because if you care about protecting the unborn, fighting Zika virus is a way of doing that. So the idea of messing around with that money actually has outraged some pro-life people, which is,
Yeah, if you want to get disappointed and frustrated with Congress, just look at what they've done with this. I mean, this is a public health issue, and it just played politics shamelessly. I mean, it ended up with one of the things that was added in was a Confederate flag attachment of, how does that end up in a Zika bill? Just figure out a way to get this funding done, and now we're headed to the 4th of July break, and so it's all very frustrating and disappointing the more you read about it.
Do you think that's just like the new way of legislating things, is trying to sneak riders in or amendments into other bills that you're trying to pass? Because it just seems like this is happening more and more frequently.
No, it's not. It's not new. It's a trick that the majority parties have played in federal level, and you know that you should be around Tallahassee when they, you know, when they were getting ready to adjourn and watch the trains of legislation coming through.
Yeah, I've seen that before.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's not new. It's unfortunately what happens.
Yeah, there was some movement at one time to outlaw that practice of tacking on these unrelated amendments to bills, but I don't think it really went anywhere because they like doing it.
What's the type of thing that actually does frustrate people when Mark talks about, if you want to be disappointed, look at this, that we like to think of Congress as they go up and they study an issue and they make a vote on it, but that's not how legislation works. It's always, you know, what else is part of the bill and who am I trading favors with? And, you know, it's nice in a storybook sort of bill becomes a law sort of way that, you know, that song will now be stuck in your head.
Yes.
You know, that you can just imagine just a single vote, but that's not reality.
And back to what this is about public health. That's what makes it frustrating. It'd be different if it were some other thing they were debating. That's what, and there's a sense of urgency. It is July in Florida. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have mosquitoes now. And that's just what I find infuriating. And now they'll be going on break soon, and they may not get anything done before that.
Although I'm not sure what they can do to fight Zika besides dump more poison into the waterways and into the air, because you know the only way to fight it is to kill mosquitoes. There's no cure, so we're basically just going to poison our entire state in the hopes that we're not going to spread Zika.
I think also just it's a more individual thing too. Get rid of standing water around your house and mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. But so we've run out of time there. But finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. Only in Florida do people steal cars just to get to their favorite breakfast spot. This happened in Crestview, Florida. 28-year-old Marcus Trey Johnson is facing grand theft auto charges after police say he stole a van so he could drive it to the Waffle House.
That makes perfect sense.
It does.
I'm going to go on the record. Waffle House is awesome.
Scattered, smothered, and covered, y'all. Yes.
Officers tracked the van's GPS to the restaurant and also a truck stop. It was later found at Johnson's home. He told them he had no idea how it got there. No word on whether he had his hash browns smothered or scattered or covered.
Wow, we know who doesn't go to Waffle House.
Yeah, I do. Sometimes I just...
it's 3 a.m.
Yeah, usually. we'll leave it at that. And only in Florida do adopted cats come with a flood warning. Officials at the Humane Society in Pompano Beach say one of its turned on a sink faucet last week, leaving the water running for 17 hours before staff shut it off. None of the animals were harmed, but the water did cause about $5,000 worth of damages to floors, cabinets, and more. The cat was recently adopted, and the new owners were told it's intelligent enough to turn on faucets. I guess so. And that is our Only in Florida for today. Thanks to our media panel, Mark Woods, Claire Goforth, Tim Gibbons, and John Burr. Much more still to come after this break. Back in a moment with more First Coast Connect.
Who is your American Graduate Champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American Graduate Champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is July 15th at 5 p.m. Click the button on WJCT.org to nominate your American Graduate Champion today.
With so much regret in the air, are the people who voted to leave sticking to their guns?
I've voted out, not for me personally, but for my children and grandchildren.
So that's a yes. I'm Kai Rizdahl, pro-Brexit voters in the north of England. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world. WJCT and Baptist Health invite you to Girls Day Out, Saturday, September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, great speakers, including celebrity chef My Fam, and Good Morning America host and breast cancer survivor Amy Robach. Tickets are $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
From Body Double to Carrie to The Untouchables, what shaped the mind that made those movies? Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo.
There was something about the way the story was told and the cinematic language used in it that connected to me, even though at that point I was studying to be an engineer.
Filmmaker Brian De Palma later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Brian Bank, in for Melissa Ross. Summer is a time that kids look forward to all year. They're off school and they get to give their brains a rest. But for many parents, it's also a time of the year to dread. They usually have to figure out a way to ensure their children are being cared for when they're at work. But even when they are able to be at home, kids are still that much more susceptible to injury. Here to give us some tips about minimizing risks are two UF Health Trauma One injury prevention experts, Dr. Marie Crandall.
Hello.
And Rebecca Melvin.
Good morning.
So in your experience, Dr. Crandall, what's the most common injury that you've seen on the job for kids like during the summer?
So summer is very similar to the rest of the year in that the most common cause of injury and death is motor vehicle related injuries, which is almost half of the fatalities that we see and about half of the injuries. And that doesn't change in the summer. It just becomes more frequent. But there are some very summer-related injuries that do spike in those 3 months where children have more free time. One is drownings, and Florida in particular has the highest rate of drowning of any state in the nation. Around the country, it is also common, particularly in coastal states, but in Florida in particular, over 400 children die every year due to drownings. And in the ages 1 to 5 population, it's mostly in private pools or community pools as opposed to rivers and lakes. So drownings are one thing that we should discuss. Another is bicycle-related injuries. So bicycle injuries certainly happen all year, especially in a warmer climate like Florida. But in the summer, children have more free time and are more likely to be on roadways and on their bicycles and have the potential for injury. And the third is injuries in locked vehicles. So mostly not children, but infants that are trapped in hot cars and hot vehicles.
Yeah, we unfortunately, I don't know if it's just increased media attention, but it seems like we've seen a frequency of these over the past couple of years. Rebecca, what are some ways UF Health is attempting to educate the public? I mean, obviously, you're here on the show, both of you are here on the show to talk about this today, but are there any barriers to getting this information out there to parents?
Well, we work at a level one trauma center, so part of our mission is not just taking care of critically injured patients, but preventing people from even coming in. So some of the stuff that we've done that we've been doing for years, specifically with what Dr. Crandall said with bike injuries, is a bike safety course that we kind of run. So we'll bring out, we have a bicycle trailer with bicycles in it. We have certified helmet fitters. That is a real thing. You have to get certified to put a helmet on someone.
Really?
There are a lot of helmets have expiration dates, just like car seats do. So a helmet that you might have had on your 4-year-old that is now a 10-year-old shouldn't necessarily go to your youngest child. So we make sure that the helmets are fitting properly.
What does this mean for parents that kind of go to the store and just like pick up, you know, one of the helmets off the rack or something like that?
There's guidelines on them. You want something that's actually rated as something that will be helpful. Just like motorcycle helmets. There's motorcycle helmets that just fit the little skull cap type, and then there's the full-face one. So you want a DOT-approved type helmet. Some of them have age limits on them. They all come with some very specific instructions on how to fit it. Just putting it on someone's head, and I'm sure we've all seen kids drive right around where the helmet's kind of up, mm-hmm. You know, falling off their back, or they don't have the chin strap on it. it's really not going to be very protective. And we have shown that if you have a properly fitting helmet and someone does fall and they hit their head on the ground, you have a less likely chance of suffering from a traumatic brain injury versus not wearing one at all.
And I want to underscore what Ms. Melvin just said. That is 100% true. So your risk of suffering a head injury after a crash, and we know this from kids who come in after bicycle crashes and have other injuries. So compared to kids who, let's say, break their arm after a bike crash, if you have on a helmet or if you do not have on a helmet, you're at least three times as likely to suffer a traumatic brain injury. And that is catastrophic. It can be fatal and it can be seriously damaging, lead to permanent brain damage. So if you do one thing when you get on a bike, put on your helmet, just like you do one thing when you get in your car. And this goes back to the number one kind of injury for children being motor vehicle related injuries. You have a child, you have an infant, put them in a car seat. You have someone who fits into a booster seat, put them in a booster seat. If they're an infant, put them in a rear-facing car seat in the back. And if they're an old enough child to be wearing a seatbelt, have them put on a seatbelt, because it reduces the likelihood of dying in a crash by 80%. Do one thing, put on a seatbelt or put on a bike helmet.
Now, Dr. Crandall, in reference to the second most important point you were making here about pools, many homes have pools, but you know, we also go to public pools. We also find ourselves at springs or at the beach. What are your most important tips to ensuring that children are safe when they're swimming?
If there's any way at all for you to obtain classes at the Y or community programs that help for water safety and early swim training, we know that that decreases the likelihood of drowning. But if those aren't possible for you, purchasing water wings or even the little leashes that you have for small children who can wander away and get into waters unattended, so get into the deep end of the pool accidentally and not be attended, those are things that can be really helpful. And then finally, if a child does suffer a near drowning, having family trained in first aid and CPR can be very helpful and can be life-saving. So all of those classes and things are available at the Y, and some of them are supported by UF Jackson Trauma One.
There's no substitution for being aware of who's in the water. Everybody has a cell phone now. People like to go outside and read books and have drinks with friends. If you're at a pool, if there's kids in the pool, if it's your children that are in the pool, you want to make sure that there's one person that knows how to swim, preferably an adult, watching the water at all times.
Yeah, they have to be paying attention.
Period. They can have a phone near them just in case something happens to call 911, but that person really needs to be dedicated. So we have little tags and a lanyard that you can wear. It's bright yellow, so people can see it across the pool, and that person is gifted that tag as a water watcher.
Now, where can... quickly here, because we're running out of time, but lastly, is there a place online
they
with
can
these
email
guides?
Me.
Or
they can email me at trauma@jax.ufl.edu, and I will mail them to you.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining me. Have a great and safe weekend. And in a moment, we'll hear about a new initiative focusing on minority artists in Jacksonville and their stories. We'll be right back with some more First Coast Connect.
On the next Fresh Air, a personal history of LA's punk scene. We hear from John Doe and Exene Cervenka of the band X and Dave Alvin of the Blasters. Doe has put together a new book about LA punk. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, I'm John Braun. I'm an emergency planner for the city of Jacksonville, Florida. Individuals with special needs should register annually for assistance with evacuation to shelters. Visit jaxready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
When a soldier is involved in combat, sometimes the most serious wounds aren't the ones you can see. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a look at traumatic brain injuries in the military and whether they might be linked to PTSD. Plus, violence in the cities, helping kids recover from mental trauma. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
The math doesn't pencil out. You feel disaster looming in your not-too-distant horizon, but still, after much consideration, you decide to go for it. On the next Snap Judgment, we proudly present Leap of Faith. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Ryan Bank, and for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation this week. Finally this hour, the vibrancy, authenticity, and visibility of the Jacksonville arts community has grown astronomically in recent years. Local nonprofits, collectives, and businesses have embraced making Jacks weird. But some artists still feel like Some artists still feel like they're not getting a fair shake. Ebony Payne English is trying to change that. Ebony, thanks so much for joining me.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So to start off, I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about your background in art and what your particular art form is.
Okay, well, I'm from Jacksonville, and I am a poet, a hip-hop artist. And I write comic books, too, so.
Comic books, really?
And curriculum. I'm a writer. I guess I'm a writer. Like, I'm most known for my poetry and my music, because those are quite visible. But I consider myself to be a writer. I do just as much work as I've done in poetry. I'm just as accomplished as a curriculum developer and as a writer, a comic book writer, so.
Do you have a favorite, though?
No, I don't.
You don't? Okay.
I don't, but I do know that the most therapeutic is my poetry. Like, usually if I'm writing a poem, it's because I'm getting some icky stuff out of my heart and my soul.
So. That seems to be a commonality between all writers. That's the whole point, is to get it out on the page.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about your arts group, Black on Black Rhyme? How'd you come up with that name and why?
Okay, so Black on Black Rhyme is an international collective of poets, activists, and artists, educators, that started in Tallahassee, Florida. Actually, September will be our 18th year anniversary. We're grown. We're super grown now. And I'm the first woman to start her own chapter. Black on Black Rhyme, it was in response to a lot of the violence that was taking place in the South about 18 years ago. There were some tensions that were high and things were happening, the mass incarceration and a lot of other things. So Keith Rogers started a open mic in his living room, which was just a mile away from campus at FAMU. And all these people, they just had room to speak. They called it drive-bys, right? Wow. A play on it, because there wasn't enough room in his living room for everyone to come in all the time. So people would show up in carloads, and then one carload would come in to hear the artist speak.
And then they would
rotate. So they called it a drive-by.
Wow.
And so that's where Black on Black Rhyme comes from, because it was a play on Black on Black Rhyme. Crime.
Yeah. Do you consider that kind of like reclaiming those phrases, like that's
absolutely.
That's an important
redirect the energy. That's what it was intended for, and that's what we use it for now.
Yeah. And that kind of goes back to like the whole genesis of slam poetry and hip hop. That was the whole point of it. So
absolutely. Yeah.
That's really interesting. So I want to get to what Dear Jacksonville is, and how does that fit in with your existing work?
Okay, so Dear Jacksonville, Black on Black Rhyme Jax Foundation is the first nonprofit in the Black on Black Rhyme International Collective. So I'm really excited and happy about that. And so Dear Jacksonville is our flagship service campaign. And the intent is to filter $9,040 annually into the communal development and artistic growth of Jacksonville.
And communal development, that's mm-hmm. something that comes up more and more in your work. What is communal art to you, and how does that fit into the overall arts community? You've mentioned before that you think that there's some type of schism, or you feel as though there's some type of schism.
Right. So communal art for me is art that benefits the community, that recycles the energy and the intent, as well as the resources that come from it back into the community. So what that's like is pop-ups. Go to a neighborhood, pop-up, bring a play to a neighborhood that maybe doesn't have access to Players by the Sea or Theater Jacksonville or transportation to the Ritz. We bring it to them, bring the show to them. Also, it looks like making sure our artists are able to make living wages here in the place they're from.
Okay, so to end off, I want to ask if you have anything that you'd like to perform for our listeners right now, any of your poetry.
Well, we're talking about Dear Jacksonville, so I can perform that piece. It's called Dear Jacksonville, and it's a love letter that my city, it was inspired by my city. So.
All right.
When you left for college, without a goodbye or second look, I did not reach for you. I folded your playmates and brothers into cul-de-sacs, cop cars, body bags, their pants sag and foot drag did not permit them haste. They did not get away. The bullets did not have names. They rang and rang. Their receivers could not answer. Why were you the solitary dancer? Moving and shaking, cling breaking from my clasp, I knew you'd be back. For the funerals and court dates, for the sentencing and releases, you talk about me in your pieces like I'm some kind of monster, swallowing young people out of spite, the brave heroine to slice through the belly and pull them out alive, you lie. Poems don't return spirits to bones. And truth be told, you were gone too long to save Boo. Nate, too. Justin was digested and passed through the system with a minimum of 10 years. You left them here out of fear for your own life when it was I who allowed you to thrive. The same sidewalks with white chalk outlines of your friends and kin were once stained with the blacked out frame of your hopscotch game, my dear St. John. Welcome you to its banks. Inspired your pen with its bends. It was different then. You were the spark in my parks after dark. Your smile was bright and wide. The flicker of your flashlight on summer nights gave me so much pride. You don't look me in the eyes anymore. You frown at my sores and poke at my scars when I made you who you are. You are sore and scarred too. I'm your village.
Ebony, thank you so much for being here and talking about this. I want to give your GoFundMe page. Should they just search Dear Jacksonville on GoFundMe?
It's Dear Jacksonville on GoFundMe.com, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here.
No problem.
That's our program for today. Thank you to all of our guests and callers. The show's producer is Sean Birch. Melissa Ross will be back Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. Have a safe and happy holiday weekend, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.